Round the World with Reporters.
Once again, crimes committed by the Israeli regime have been debated in the European Parliament. Lawmakers condemn the brutal murder on the 11th of May of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier.
Too often we, here in Europe, look away when the spiral of violence continues, when new settlements plans are announced, or when another journalist gets killed or wounded.
Clearly wearing press attire, 51-year-old Abu Akleh was murdered in cold blood while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. During her funeral, Israeli forces attacked mourners.
The European Union is appalled by the events that took place during the funeral procession. The EU condemned this disproportionate use of force and the disrespectful behaviour.
Western media and Western leaders have been accused of turning a blind eye to the international law violations continuously perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime in the occupied territories.
Increased settler violence around the settlements, clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem during the Ramadan, forced evictions and demolitions in the West Bank, including of EU-funded projects.
Tel Aviv has been urged to fully cooperate with an independent inquiry into Shireen's murder. The EU says that's important in order to maintain the bloc's close partnership with Israel.
When situations like this arise, we say it is very important for this partnership to continue in its high quality, that we have clarity about things that are happening, which are actually against our principles and our values.
EU legislators urge the West not to give up on the idea of a two-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict.
The tragic death of Shireen Abu Akleh is a sad reminder of the spiral of violence taking place that continues to haunt this region.
The European Parliament debate heard that Israel has killed around 50 Palestinian journalists during the past two decades. It goes without saying then that Shireen was not the first and almost certainly will not be the last. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Months after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, confessed that Washington was mainly to blame for the collapse of the former Afghan government and national security and defense forces. The report by SIGAR reveals that Afghan forces' morale were destroyed after then-U.S. President Donald Trump reached a deal with the Taliban in 2020, and President Joe Biden affirmed the U.S. withdrawal in 2021.
In my opinion, the Doha deal paved the way for the U.S.-led foreign forces' withdrawal from Afghanistan. It also gave the Taliban forces the belief that they can take over Afghanistan easily. In fact, the Doha deal and the U.S. withdrawal both were great achievements for the Taliban and Afghanistan.
Former Afghan generals and experts also told the agency that most American support to Afghan forces was stopped or limited, while the Taliban had intensified attacks.
I agree with the SIGAR report. The former Afghan Republic government was defeated when the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban. After the Doha deal, the U.S. stopped its major logistic support, including fuel, rockets, arms, and air support to Afghan forces. It continued until the Afghan army completely ran out of equipment.
SIGAR notes that in essence, U.S. and Afghan efforts to cultivate an effective and sustainable security assistance sector were likely to fail from the beginning. Afghan experts also say that the U.S. never meant to build a nation or a state in the country, and all Western-backed armies are doomed to failure.
The former Afghan government was an example of American state-building. They invaded our country, formed their own government, and finally demolished it. They never meant to boost the state-nation process. The Americans appointed their own men to the Afghan government, while they were not representing Afghan people. In addition, the U.S. intentionally established a corrupt and dependent army in Afghanistan.
The Taliban took over Afghanistan in August 2021 as the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan and the former Western-backed government collapsed. Afghans are angry with the U.S. for pushing Afghanistan into a dire situation. People here believe Washington not only betrayed Afghans but also continues to harm them with sanctions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, a recent order by the authorities is giving sleepless nights to many business owners and shopkeepers. Business owners, big and small, are spending hundreds of dollars each to install security cameras. a mandatory move ordered by the authorities. The official order says the scheme will deter criminals, antisocial and anti-national elements. The order also outlines the minimum standards for camera resolution, infrared capability and range. The government's order has been highly criticized by business owners. They describe the move as a callous approach towards warrior-y Kashmir's fractured business establishments, which were deeply dented after India cancelled Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019.
Everybody knows the quantum of the business, it's almost 80% down. It was their duty to install the CC camera. Why to tell to the business you install the CC TV cameras? You see, the 80% of the business company, they cannot afford to install this CCTV camera. So I think they should review this decision and they should look into this.
Muzaffar Jan, a shop owner in the heart of Srinagar's busiest market, Lal Chowk, says it has been days since he has seen a customer at his store. However, to follow the police instructions, he was forced to pull out the money he had saved for running his household.
I waited for around a week to see whether others would install cameras. Later, I was forced because of continuous announcements and strict orders. I installed the camera. It took me around $1,000 and not everyone can afford this cost. In Kashmir, there are frequent power cuts and to keep the camera plugged in, I had to install an uninterrupted power supply inverter. Many of us can't manage two meals a day. How can we afford these cameras?
The order further instructs that the cameras installed at the business owner's expense must always stay on. The system should record and store footage for 30 days and must be produced on demand of police and other law enforcement agencies without any court order. And failure to abide by the order will result in a fine or month-long imprisonment. The level of surveillance in Kashmir is increasing day by day. Authorities argue that the measure will help them protect people's lives, but Kashmiris are calling the move as a worrying development and see it as a threat to their human rights, privacy and dignity. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Much of Mariupol may lie in ruins, but the city is already coming back to life after months of fierce fighting. A market is open, selling all essential goods, and humanitarian aid is being distributed by organizations associated with the Russian government.
These days the situation is more or less stabilized. People are fed, there are more problems with water, electricity and gas in some parts, and there are still problems with basic domestic needs.
Amongst the ruins, I came across a gathering who are waiting for a drop-off of humanitarian supplies.
During the fighting, I was at home. When there were battles, the house was shaking. I stood with my back to the wall and I was shaking with the wall. When I think of it, I still shiver. There was nothing good about the fighting. We don't want anything except peace and quiet now.
The population of Mariupol before the war was about 450,000. Now, it's hard to estimate, but we think around a third of those people still remain, either stayed during the battle or stayed nearby the city and camps and have now returned. Over the next days, weeks, months, years, we can expect many thousands of people to return here to Mariupol. But who will be those people? Before the conflict began, the city was very mixed between pro-Russian, Russian-speaking people and more Ukrainian nationalist, pro-Ukrainian people. Now that it's under Russian control, as long as it stays under Russian control, we can expect many of the Russian people to come back. But for the Ukrainians, they may well stay away, which means that the ethnic diversity in the city, the ethnic makeup of the city, will change.
It is not yet time to be happy about anything, but there are certain expectations that Russia is a rich country and its politics are more independent, and we hope things will improve.
How do you feel living under Russian rule now rather than Ukrainian?
You see, we cannot say anything yet. We don't understand anything yet. We only want it to be peaceful and quiet. That's what people want here. What else can we say?
Like many people I speak to in areas recently taken over by Russia, she is scared to answer such questions. She may be more pro-Ukrainian, or she might be worried that Russia
might not be in control of Mariupol for long. Down by the port area, I found the incongruous sight of fishermen, seemingly oblivious to the fact that war was still raging across the country.
Of course I am happy. Of course. Truth to tell, we've been waiting for it for a long time. Of course, yes, I'm happy to be under Russian control now, because we have become free. Well, we were free before, but not in this way. The attitude changed. People have a different attitude to each other now. Earlier, we were afraid to say things and speak our minds. Yes, I could get into trouble if I criticized the Ukrainian government.
This is commonly heard amongst Russian speakers here, that they have been marginalized and persecuted by the increasingly nationalist Ukrainian government. This is the reason the East rose up 8 years ago, and why many here welcome the Russians. Unless Ukraine takes back Mariupol, it will now likely be populated predominantly by an ethnic Russian population. Whatever the fate of this city, it will never be the same again. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The controversial idea of creating an EU army has now come to pass in all but name. The European Commission confirmed on Wednesday the bloc's 27 nations have agreed to jointly spend €200 billion on military hardware over the next few years.
Joint procurement is better operationally for our armed forces, because this strengthens the interoperability between the armed forces.
Citizens are struggling to survive, mainly due to the economic fallout from the conflict in Ukraine. But it appears EU authorities have other priorities.
We need modern air defences. We need drones. We need air-to-air refueling capabilities. We need tanks and armoured vehicles. We need coastal defence.
Anti-war demonstrators in Brussels say the extra billions being spent on NATO and the EU army cannot be justified.
Just those people are saying that we have to secure ourselves. Against who? Against what? Against, I don't know.
We want Belgium out of NATO, and we want NATO out of Belgium.
The European Commission insists the EU's military spending plan will complement the work of NATO, not erode it. But military experts are saying that is inevitable. And they say the project has already seriously undermined NATO's credibility. The Commission has also just announced an additional €9 billion for the Ukrainian government.
Since the beginning of Russia's aggression on 24th of February, the EU has provided €4.1 billion to help Ukraine.
Hard-pressed EU taxpayers might wonder how the money will be spent. Last September, the bloc's financial watchdog revealed how corruption is rife in Ukraine at every level, from the government to the judiciary. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Hamas government media office has held a big ceremony in Gaza to pay tribute to fallen Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank last week. Palestinian journalists, academics, and senior Palestinian officials attended the ceremony. Palestinian officials accused Israeli regime forces of deliberately killing Shireen Abu Akleh.
Shireen was killed in cold blood, like many Palestinian journalists. Israeli forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. We demand that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists.
Abu Akleh was wearing a press vest that identified her as a member of the press when she was shot by Israeli snipers. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, protective gear that clearly indicates individuals are journalists should grant them extra protection, not make them targets.
We demand, and I think the international community should all demand justice for Shireen Abu Akleh. What is happening from the Israeli occupation, the constant targeting of journalists, is just a systematic, ongoing, punitive reaction that keeps on going. It has been going on for so long, and it still is continuing.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Under the Geneva Conventions, journalists, like other civilians, enjoy protection amid armed conflicts.
I believe that, you know, killing Shireen Abu Akleh was not the first crime that the Israeli occupation has committed, and it won't be the last one. I believe that as long as there is a military occupation of the Palestinian territories, these crimes won't stop, especially against Palestinian journalists.
While covering Israeli attacks, Palestinian journalists work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
Observers say that Shireen Abu Akleh's killing is another example of the Israeli regime's brutality against the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
In her exclusive interview to Press TV, the UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are legal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling the for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the UN Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Palestine Embassy in Rome has placed in its premises a condolence book for people to express their grief and condemn the brutal killing of Palestinian veteran journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Shireen was covering the Israeli troops' raid in Jenin for Al Jazeera last Wednesday when she was shot in the head by Israeli forces. Her tragic death and the beating of Palestinian mourners during Shireen's funeral sent shockwaves across the region.
I know Shireen personally. My reaction was crying for hours. We felt really sorry, deeply inside. We felt sorry because we feel that we are alone. Where is the international community? Why they are staying silent for suffering of 14 million Palestinians?
On Tuesday, a number of Italian lawmakers went to visit the Palestinian ambassador to Rome to sign the condolence book for Shireen. The delegation of parliamentarians sat with the Palestinian diplomat to discuss how to get the Italian government involved in urging the international community to break its silence in regards with Israeli crimes.
We will file a parliamentary motion in which we demand the government to commit to set up an international investigation committee on what happened in Jenin and during the journalist's funeral.
The United Nations and the European Union, among others, have called for a full investigation into Shireen's assassination, described by many as a deliberate killing in cold blood. Problems have once again emerged in reporting the truth regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. That comes as most mainstream media have provided a biased portrayal of the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh, omitting Israel's responsibility and considering as facts only the statement issued by the Israeli Defense Forces.
Unfortunately, it is a total double standard when it comes to Italian newspapers reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When there are clashes in that region, journalists say Palestinians die while Israelis are killed.
Thousands of Palestinians residing in Italy have commemorated the Nakba through a number of small and large initiatives. They say the assassination of Shireen is one of the many ways Tel Aviv seeks to silence those that expose the apartheid regime. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
In Britain, a charitable organisation, Action for Children, says levels of severe and persistent hardship in cost of living crisis are among the worst that it has ever seen. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Patrick Butler. The piece is titled, Poor Families Skipping Meals and Unable to Afford Heating, Charity Says. In Britain, hard-up families are skipping meals, wearing coats indoors to stay warm, and living in the dark because they can't afford to switch on the lights, according to a leading children's charity. Action for Children said in one case, a boy it worked with had been off school with sore feet caused by chilblains. The boy told charity workers that the house was cold all the time because the heating was not on, and that he and his siblings were wearing coats inside and sharing beds at night to keep warm. In another case, a parent told charity workers that she would take care of her toddler to bed with their tea when they got back from nursery, just to keep warm. Other clients described being unable to afford school uniforms, or struggling to afford food, or trying to heat a room with a single gas hob. Current levels of severe and persistent hardship among British families supported by the charity's Children's Centre, triggered by cuts to universal credit and rising energy bills, were among the worst that it could remember, said Action for Children's Director of Policy, Imran Hussain. The worst pain and misery of the cost of living crisis is being felt by children in low-income families. Yet the government is refusing to target help for these children or accept that it needs to rethink its huge cut to universal credit, he said. Ministers have refused to commit to extra direct help for families despite an average annual £700 rise in household fuel costs since April, and also rising food insecurity. Families faced the fastest fall in living standards this year since the 1950s, according to the Office for Budget Responsibility. Children's Hardship Fund set up by the charity Action for Children 2 years ago to provide one-off help to struggling families during the pandemic has evolved into a permanent crisis fund, helping thousands of families, it said. Since October, it has helped almost 2,500 families with grants of about £250 each, half of which were spent on food. Leanne, a mother of two and finance officer from the West Country, said she had needed food vouchers from the Action for Children Crisis Fund because she could not keep up with rising food prices and energy costs. It was a struggle anyway, but things are now so much worse. A lot of people think that food banks are just for people who don't work, but people who work like me need them as well, she said. Analysis of the Crisis Fund showed that half of families accessing it for help reported stress, anxiety, or mental health concerns among the adults or children. One in five applications highlighted the £20 cut in universal credit last October as a trigger for the family's difficulties. Iceland Foods Charitable Foundation, which has donated £300,000 to the fund since November, said that while it was thrilled to help there were limits to its philanthropic work. The charity said government especially had a key role to play in offering a lifeline to families in crisis. Paul Dhaliwal, the trading director of Iceland Foods and a trustee of the foundation, said, "We know that lots of our customers are facing real hardship. Many were badly impacted by the pandemic, and the soaring cost of living crisis has only added to their difficulties." A British government spokesperson said, "We recognise the pressures on the cost of living, and we're doing what we can to help, including spending £22 billion across the next financial year to support people with energy bills and cut fuel duty. For the hardest hit families, we're putting an average of £1,000 more per year into the pockets of working families on universal credit. We've also boosted the minimum wage by more than £1,000 a year for full-time workers, and our household support fund is there to help with the cost of everyday essentials."
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. In this edition, the BRICS countries have backed a Chinese suggestion that the bloc should be expanded. A joint statement by the foreign ministers of the bloc, which also includes Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, following an online meeting on Thursday, supported its first expansion in a decade. However, no candidate countries have been named so far. In this edition of Spotlight, we will be discussing the possible expansion of BRICS and what that means on a global scale. To discuss that further, we have with us the Washington Bureau Chief Executive Intelligence Review, William Jones, and also author and journalist Arnold August. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's begin with our guest, William Jones. Why do you think BRICS's expansion is being proposed at this point in time?
Well, look, what you have in the world now is the United States is out to bring the countries of the world together in a policy of degrading Russia, essentially decoupling Russia from the world community, in effect. They have succeeded in bringing their European counterparts on board, although not without opposition. And now, of course, President Biden is in Japan working on the Asia-Pacific side of this. This campaign is, first of all, directed against Russia, but also against China. The United States administration, the Biden administration today, has the policy that they must be the rule givers of the world. It is a policy of great hubris. And of course, hubris is also sometimes a very dangerous quality. Most of the world is opposed to this policy, including, I believe, even within the countries that have gone along with it. I think they're going to see a lot of opposition. China knows that it is also a target of this policy, has extensive relations with many, many countries, and has been a strong proponent of economic development over the last 10, 20 years, actually the strongest proponent. The BRICS cooperation has been a part of bringing together countries, particularly in the developing sector, to call for more multilateralism, to assure that other countries other than the great powers, so-called, have a say in the direction of the world. And at this point in time, of course, there is a question. Where is the world going? Will it go to this one world dictatorship of the United States, or will other countries become involved and raise their voices? The other countries are not organized in the same way as NATO and the U.S. alliances, and therefore I think this is a step in the direction of increasing the number of groups that are working together to defend the issue of multilateralism.
Okay, so Mr. August, we just heard Mr. Jones pointing to some geostrategic developments, including the war in Ukraine and the U.S.-led NATO expansion and all that. Do you think that that has anything to do with a BRICS decision to expand and enroll more countries? What is your point of view on that?
Definitely, I agree. In fact, one has to take into account that this is the first BRICS meeting since the February 24th Russian special military operation in Ukraine. It's very significant, I guess a bit ironic, because in my view, one of the reasons that the NATO pushed Russia to the brink was to try and weaken Russia. As a result, what they don't like is the increasing collaboration between Russia and China. So here we've come full circle since then, today, in May, when China has bounced back in order to propose the enlargement of BRICS. And if I recall correctly, the five members of BRICS, three of them abstained when the United Nations General Assembly voted on the American-backed resolution to impose sanctions against Russia. So three out of five abstain. So right there you have another ripple effect of what happened since February 2000, this past year. And once again, I think it's poetic justice that China is at the center, along with their allies on an equal basis, such as the other members of BRICS, to strive to expand the already burgeoning, already developing multipolar world against U.S. hegemony. It has very important effects. For example, even in Latin America, there is a big controversy going on now with regards to the U.S. so-called Summit of the Americas in June 2022, in which they are excluding countries such as Cuba, Venezuela, etc. So you have a situation now where perhaps will Argentina be asked to become one of the additional members of BRICS, which is quite possible, because Argentina visited China at a crucial time when the U.S. Narrative against Russia was taking place. And what if Argentina is asked to join BRICS? It would be great. And then how will this affect the upcoming summit that's going to take place in Los Angeles, if it takes place, because so many countries have refused to bow down to the U.S. dictate that they are excluding Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. So this is only the beginning. I think it will have very important effects, not only in Latin America, obviously in Europe, and also the rest of Asia.
Okay, so Mr. Jones, as Mr. August also pointed out, we have Argentina standing in line. Earlier this year, Argentina had expressed its desire to join the bloc, and analysts say Indonesia is also a likely candidate. How could these two countries contribute to the bloc? Or would this change BRICS?
Well, no, I think it would strengthen BRICS, as a matter of fact. BRICS has, of course, its economic cooperation, but it's also, they make statements on the international situation, which are extremely important. And in spite of the diversity of countries, they can always find some commonality with regard to the direction that the world should go. That is, commonalities in terms of supporting statements, for instance, as in the BRICS statement today, calling for peace negotiations on the Ukraine-Russia border, which, of course, the United States is opposed to and is does not want to see happen anytime soon until Russia is degraded. So that it has an important political role, but it also an important economic role. And this is one of the organizations. Look, the developing countries over the last 50 years have done a lot of things to try and bring together their united force in order to bring forward a global development policy. This has never really succeeded. We go back to the Bandung Conference, which was probably the initial attempt at this, and it hasn't succeeded. It hasn't succeeded because they haven't been able to create the kind of a force that can counter the power of the Western economies in determining the fate of the world. And therefore, this will bring together whatever choices are made in the short term. And I do see that an expansion of BRICS will not be limited only to one or two countries, but potentially it can be even greater, because this is one of the main organizations that has been consistently pushing for global development policy. And of course, you know that you notice that President Xi addressed the BRICS meeting, and he underlined two major important points. One is the need for this global security initiative, that is, that the world must be based on the idea that the security of one nation cannot be done at the expense of another nation. Of course, this is what is central to this whole Russia-Ukraine crisis. And the second thing was that he insisted that they work together collaboratively on the issue of development. And of course, China has put forward this global development initiative, which, if realized, would begin to repeat the successes that China has had in their own country in terms of poverty alleviation. So these are things in which the BRICS countries, as they're constituted today, in addition of any other developing sector countries, would only strengthen the momentum towards development and towards peace. So I think this is a very important step that they're taking.
Okay, so Mr. August, you seem to be agreeing with our other guests here. So I would like to know what you think about how the expansion of BRICS can change the political landscape.
Okay, well, the previous speaker already mentioned that point, but I would like to expand on one point. In addition to the obvious economic factors of integration and cooperation, there are very important political factors. Just reading from the Chinese report, according to it, Xi Jinping, he said that these five countries should coordinate closely on major international and regional issues, take care of each other's core interests and concerns, and respect each other's sovereignty, security, and development interests. And President Xi went on to say to oppose hegemonism and power politics. And this is important in my view. He went on to say, resist Cold War thinking and block confrontation. So it's economic, but I think it's a very important step in terms of the resisting the Cold War that is sweeping the world as a result of U.S.-NATO domination. And this is sort of a challenge to that mainstream narrative that people should, of the world, country especially in the global south, should stand up to this whole very dangerous narrative that is going on, and instead take a common position, even if they have different political system, which they obviously did. For example, Brazil at this time on one hand, and China on the other, India, of course, very different political and economic system, but China is playing an important role to try to weld these different countries with different system towards an increasingly stronger opposition to U.S. hegemony and in favor of a multipolar world.
Well, exactly, and of course, we also have to point out that this announcement comes at a time that the BRICS New Development Bank, the NDP, has opened its Indian regional office. So, Mr. Jones, how can financial cooperation between the member states affect Western hegemony?
Well, it's obviously the initiation of the Belt and Road Initiative was a game changer in development policy. For the first time in decades, there was a major shift, major push to try and institute development based on interconnectivity, based on building railroads, bringing the world together. This has always been central. The United States developed like this. Russia developed like this. Railroads and connectivity is essential to creating the basis of infrastructure in which economic development can occur. Now, what also happened at that time is that new institutions like the AIIB and the BRICS New Development Bank were set up specifically to finance infrastructure development. The old development banks, World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, they had long left the field of infrastructure development because they felt it takes too long financially, there's not quick profits, and a variety of reasons, and a general disinterest in any kind of major program to create economic development in places like Africa and Latin America. And that these new development banks, like the BRICS Development Bank, created a new momentum. They're going to be even more important now because, look, the money that is being spent on this war effort and the sanctions that are being imposed on Russia in particular, but also on China, is going to create a major financial crisis in the world. We're looking at what's happening in food prices now and energy prices. This is going to get much, much worse, making it almost impossible for without a major reform of the international financial system for any kind of development policies in these parts of the world. So that's also what the fight is all about, to try and maintain the financial capabilities of pushing economic development. And it's going to take more than simply the existence of these various banks. It's going to require a major reform of the international financial system. And my suspicion is that given the dangerous situation that we're facing with the real possibilities of a nuclear war, I think there's going to be such serious economic consequences that you're going to have a reaction in most of the countries of the world against this war policy. And maybe that would provide the basis for people to take a look and say, pull together a financial system that works for the benefit of the people and not for the profits of the few.
Okay, so considering what Mr. Jones just mentioned, Mr. August, do you think that this kind of financial cooperation can help counter U.S. sanctions?
Well, I think it is actually happening now, especially since February 24th, 2022, where there have been, collaboration with regards to currency going on between, on the one hand, Russia and China and other countries in Asia. So this new BRICS orientation, especially if it allows and is successful in bringing other countries into BRICS, it'll even stimulate further the search for alternative currencies based on the U.S. dollar. For example, I don't have the exact figures, but since the U.S. tried to punish Russia with regards to currency, the ruble, the value of the ruble has increased considerably. So there are very many possibilities that are coming out of this new situation. I'd just like to add one point. When the United Nations General Assembly took place and the U.S. resolution to condemn Russia, China abstained. Some people say, oh, well, why didn't China oppose it? China was right. It abstained in order to maintain its very favorable position internationally as an important power, not imperialist, as some would like to say, but an important progressive anti-imperialist power to try to rally other countries that have different political systems and even perhaps different views on the issue of Russia. So this very wise Chinese decision to abstain in the United Nations is now bearing fruit, as we see China is being successful in further developing a whole block against U.S. hegemony, not only with regards to Ukraine, but in general, all of U.S. policy. For example, looking forward to China, we know the United States is also trying to provoke something with regards to Taiwan. So these countries, BRICS, and any new countries that adhere to BRICS will be on the side of China against the attempt that we know is going on by the U.S. to try to provoke something with regards to China by instigating some kind of a rebellion or whatever by Taiwan against the Chinese government.
Okay, so Mr. Jones, do you believe that this could all lead to the weakening of the U.S. dollar?
Well, it already is. And, of course, in terms of the financial cooperation between Russia and China, there are already measures being taken in order to maintain the cooperation in terms of the physical economy. Financial arrangements are being made. The RMB is already playing a major role, not as a reserve currency, but as a currency which is becoming dominant in many of the transactions that China has with all the other countries. So in one sense, the United States could be shooting itself in the foot with this $30 billion to Ukraine rather than to New York or to California, because that is causing major inflation. The dollar is going down. The stock market is at least starting to tank, and it's up and down, but it's moving in the direction downward. And this may end the dollar hegemony, which has been really the stronghold of American power, together with military powers, that financial power. And it's American, it's Anglo-American, I must say, because New York isn't the center of international finance. London is and always has been. But they're hand in hand, hand in glove with the United States. That system economically is being threatened with the effects of all this spending and the sanctions, the effect it's having on the dollar. So I think things are already in the works as emergency measures in the financial realm, which could very well serve as the basis or the core of a new international financial system when the dust settles after this crisis.
Okay, so Mr. August, we're running out of time, but this is also a very important question. China has pointed to, quote, factors of instability and insecurity, which are increasing, and has suggested that BRICS members should strengthen mutual political trust and security cooperation. Does this mean that we should be looking at an alliance between countries involved in activities far beyond economic cooperation?
I think we have already been a witness to this tendency of increased cooperation of countries, especially in the global south, to oppose U.S. hegemony and oppose what I guess many people in the south see, unlike in Western Europe or in North America, as U.S. provocations, especially against the global south. We recall not too long ago when the United States was pressuring Pakistan to vote with the U.S. against Russia in the United Nations General Assembly, the then president of Pakistan say, no way, we are not lackeys of the U.S. So this has, you know, very far repercussion. That was a setback, what happened in Pakistan, but I'm quite sure this could reverse itself, and Pakistan could go back to the type of government that they had before, which was really a coup against it. So there are a lot of features, countries, interests, that do not want to succumb to all the U.S. provocations that they carry out throughout the world with their 800 military bases, opening up new military bases, doing combined military operations with between the United States and other countries of the West in the South China Sea. So the more countries rally around BRICS and support that overall position against U.S. hegemony, and as you say, very concerning destabilization measures. So this new BRICS alignment expansion led by China is playing and is going to play a very important role in the international landscape in the coming weeks and months.
Okay, Mr. Arnold August, author and journalist out of Montreal, and William Jones, a Washington bureau chief of the Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg. That's all the time that we have for this edition of The Spotlight.